Hey Jordan, how's it going?
What's up, Rob?
Not much. I'm a little tired. It was an all-nighter going to that huge event with Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, my three guys. I'm often talking about them.
Oh yeah.
And I went to that live. They're podcasting. They're in the content game now.
Well, look, I think it's good that you're getting out. You know, I've just been worried that you've been spending too much time inside. But I did notice there is a significant amount of money missing from the subscription fund.
Yeah.
This month. By chance, would you know anything about that? That wouldn't have happened to
I have no
cover
idea.
The cost of the tickets or anything? No?
No. No. And, okay. You know, I know it cost a pretty penny to go and you know meet the guys and shake their hands and everything, but I paid for that with a totally separate thing. It was not affiliated with our profits or anything like that. So that's we can definitely look into that. We can circle back on that.
Well,
and take
I
a look
noticed,
at that definitely.
I hear you, and you know I'm not calling you out. I did notice that. For a selfie at that event, it was $100,000, and I noticed that we're in the red by $99,500.
Nice try.
Math on that one, yeah.
That's okay.
We're in debt. We're in debt, Rob.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's you have one opportunity. If you had one chance, mm-hmm. one opportunity, a famous philosopher once used these words. If you had one chance, one opportunity, would you take it? Sometimes in those moments, you just have to take the big step. And that's all. I got a selfie with the guys. So I think that's really what's the most important thing here. And we don't need to discuss it anymore, I don't think.
Okay.
was that a podcast? Like, was that just like a live event?
I think
or whatever,
it was just,
or was that...
It was just, yeah, a conversation, okay. A live conversation facilitated or moderated by Stephen Colbert.
Okay, I see. Cool. Must have been great.
Yeah, really. I've got a ton of FOMO.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, man. Just imagining the type of people that would be showing up to that thing. When Stephen Colbert's a powerful moral center and his Catholicism really enabled him to have this softball interview with Biden while he's sitting atop a mountain of corpses as well. I'm sure he asked a lot of hard-hitting questions about that.
Yeah, it was like, of what I saw, it was poking fun at Trump's golf game. That was like the clip I saw.
Yes.
I'm just like, you haven't won a Trump International Golf Tournament. Like, I mean, also, he's not going to ask him tough questions. It was a fundraiser. Like the point of it was to fundraise for Biden and then Democrats down the ballot. So that was not an opportunity to do it. But it makes you wonder where people in media see themselves in their role. And
yeah,
I just don't think, I mean, not that late night hosts are ever going to be the source of hardball questions, but
no, I know.
He was always good. He was good on political commentary. He was funny. I think he still is funny, but it's just like, it kind of sucks to see.
Yeah, I guess I find it really kind of gross the way that like a lot of people in the media, not just people like in journalists or commentators or whatever, but comedians during the Trump era found this like moral responsibility, and they found it within themselves to like really kind of like speak out about the various abuses of the various like horrible things that Trump was doing, whether it came to the southern United States border or any of the horrific things that Trump stood for when he was president. And I think it's just emblematic of this kind of like partisan brainworms that people have, that it's like these kind of comedians, late night talk show hosts, they were able to kind of like find it within themselves to speak truth to power when Donald Trump was president. And then it's like when Joe Biden becomes president of the United States, continues a lot of Trump's border policies, as we've discussed at length on this show, totally subsidizes one of the most horrific mass murder ethnic cleansing campaigns that we've seen in modern history, and just fully supports that and pays for it. And then, you know, there's zero effort or ability for some of these folks to offer up the same kind of like strong moral critique. I think it's just emblematic of the way that like politics is discussed in this kind of like team sports way. It's not really about policies. It's not really about the actions of these people in power. It's purely about, whose team is in charge and who's not. And it's just frustrating. It's frustrating, especially for someone like Colbert, who I think years ago, I think did have a lot of like teeth in his kind of commentary and mm-hmm. did have this willingness to kind of challenge people. I mean, Colbert at the press correspondents dinner with George W. Bush all those years ago, like, you know, to the president's face was like really kind of openly criticizing and mocking him, and like had this really kind of like pointed critique of Bush. And then, you know, that's what I mean. You have in the 15 years later, just like palling around with Obama and Clinton and Biden and just raising money for the Democratic Party. It's just kind of sad to see. It's depressing.
Yeah.
Anyway, folks, welcome back to the show. Thank you for tuning in. If you missed it, me and Jordan did a, or is it Jordan and I? It's Jordan and I. Jordan and whenever I say that, I think about my mom giving me the correction. Jordan and I, we had a great conversation earlier this week where we talked about libs of TikTok and her inability to answer basic questions about her whole ideology, the Planet Fitness bomb threats, that she, you know, in my opinion, in any ways, helped to inspire. We talked about California's minimum wage increase and this attack by Israel on World Central Kitchen aid workers, which has created a whole lot of controversy over the last couple of days, and seems to actually have inspired now an actual shift in the Biden administration's approach to this. We'll see if it actually amounts to anything. But this is something as well that we talked about with our guest today, Asil Rad.
Really good conversation. Also, if you are listening on Spotify, just today we enabled you to get those premium episodes directly through your Spotify app. So if you subscribe, it'll have instructions for how to listen to the premium episodes in Spotify if that's what you use to listen to the show. So it's already on Apple, the premium episodes. Now they're also on Spotify.
Yeah. So again, we thank everyone who supports the show and subscribes, our beloved paid interns. That's how you get those bonus episodes. Which we've got some really amazing episodes and amazing guests over the past several weeks and months. So please subscribe if you can, insurgentspod.com. And today we do have a fantastic conversation coming up with Middle East scholar and author and analyst Asil Rad.
Our conversation with Asil Rad was really good. We talked about the World Central Kitchen attack, Biden talking to Netanyahu, putting pressure on him, and much more on how people talk about it, how people see the conflict, how people see Palestinians, and where we go from here as we potentially see changes from Netanyahu, from the IDF, as a result of this meeting between Biden and Netanyahu. Really, really good conversation. Should we get into it now?
Let's get into it. Our conversation with Asil Rad will be coming up right after this.
And now we're joined by Asil Rad, a Middle East scholar and analyst. You've probably seen Asil on Twitter breaking down the media's distorted coverage of the war in Gaza, offering insight, offering analysis. Asil, we really thank you for joining us. All things considered, how are you?
All things considered, I can't complain. I appreciate being here, obviously, having this platform to discuss what's going on in Gaza, which is extremely important.
Yeah. Well, we're happy to have you. I think that's been one takeaway of mine as well. Sometimes you know, we're just exposed to such scenes of like unrelenting horror just day in and day out on our phones. Like, I feel like we're really not equipped to be handling this level of horror every day. And but yes, whenever I start feeling like somehow I'm the victim, or like that, you know, that I should be feeling bad, or that I deserve to complain about the situation, I remind myself of how completely lucky I am to, you know, be where I am and to be able to be in the comfort of my home and to be able to speak about these things like with a certain measure of safety. So that's always something that I try to remind myself, even if I do feel like, wow, it's just, this has just been an unrelenting assault on the senses for the last 6 months.
No, you're absolutely right. But it's like a collective trauma or like a collective horror. It's something that I think for those of us who have been following it, especially so closely, but for really, I haven't seen this kind of a reaction from people who have not really followed these types of events in the past. And so I think there's definitely a challenge in how people can even process what's going on. And I think that's what makes it so much worse. If we're having difficulty processing what's happening from the outside, we can't even imagine the experience of Palestinians in Gaza.
We are closing in on the 6 month mark of this war, and the death toll continues to climb. The suffering continues to grow. Just what we're seeing, it seems like every day or every week, there's just a new horror. There's just a new atrocity. And we've talked about it before on the show. Obviously, you want to remain steadfast in fighting against it, demanding a ceasefire. God, I don't know what this even looks like, but like holding people responsible, accountable. But there's always this inclination for people to just get like consumed by it and then just burn out. And I think we've seen, unfortunately, that like this strong showing of activism in the first 3 months or so of this war. It seems like, especially on the ground, people taking action, it seems like that energy is dissipated. And I don't question their commitment or their ability to care. I think that it's tough to watch this happen, feel powerless, and not get discouraged. I think a lot of people just at some point hit their breaking point. Like nothing that I do is going to change this. So what am I even doing? And because they're confronted with these just things that a human being should not see, let alone endure, I think there's just a lot of people who have just tried to mentally check out because it's just so unhealthy to look at. We're consuming atrocities, a genocide through our phones, and it's just really, really difficult for even the most well-meaning people to process.
You know, I agree with you, and there's a couple of things I think about that. One is I've actually been surprised at how, even though we've seen a decline, but the fact that you're still seeing Biden events getting disrupted, the fact that you're still seeing people out protesting. I mean, given our attention spans and how quickly we burn out, typically, like as a society for other events, it's kind of incredible how long, the fact that we're 6 months into it and it's lasted this long. And the other thing this makes me think of is, you know, the strategy of Israel for Palestinians has been for decades to basically break them, right? To break their will, to so much of the daily oppression and humiliation. Like sometimes people look at it as like, why do they do these really humiliating things to these people? I'm like, because they're trying to break them. And yet Palestinians have resisted. And so in a way, I feel like now the strategy is, let's just break everybody's collective humanity. Let's force people by through this sort of daily atrocities that people have to witness, let's just force them to accept that this is acceptable behavior. This is the status quo, normalizing destroying hospitals, normalizing starving people, but we have to keep resisting.
Yeah. To that effect, there was just a massive protest in London just a few days ago as well. So it is heartening and kind of amazing that 6 months into this, there is still this energy, even though like Jordan, I think you're right that for a lot of people, it is dissipating a little bit. But I mean, we're still seeing people, you know, putting their bodies on the line and taking their time to try and put pressure on their you know, local elected officials, local societies. So I think that's really heartening. And it seems to be having an impact. I've kind of gone back and forth with like this kind of feeling of despair, like no one is listening. None of the protests are really accomplishing anything. And like, certainly like it's nothing, like not enough has happened, but I do think it's made life difficult for certain political leaders. Here in Canada, we had them just, you know, a week or two ago finally agree to pause military shipments to Israel, which is kind of a big deal. You know, it's the kind of thing that I try to remain cynical about. And yes, it's too little too late. And no, it's not enough. But just the very fact that this kind of thing is happening is so unprecedented. And I think that really is a victory for the activists that have put pressure on the government here. And now, finally, with the Biden administration, it seems like this attack on the World Central Kitchen aid workers has finally, 6 months into them, forced their hand a little bit and caused them to try and exert some pressure on the Israeli government to stop the carnage. And, you know, again, it's not enough. Yes, it's far too late for that. But I think it still is something that's like a positive development. It's a positive sign, considering there's been moments where it just felt like this depravity was just never going to stop.
Yeah, I mean, there are reports that say Gaza will take more than a decade to recover, tens of billions of dollars. So it's when we say it's too late, it's because so much damage has already been done that in some ways we don't even have a complete understanding of it. And that's only if there was a ceasefire today, if there was a flood of humanitarian aid today, then maybe there would be a way of mitigating some of the already horrendous costs. But you're looking at a situation where that is not the case on the ground, right? These like small victories are great, but the reality on the ground for Palestinians, not only in Gaza and the West Bank as well, right? Like there's still, you're seeing more people being killed in the West Bank than have been in previous years, than have been in previous decades. So the all out sort of attack on Palestinians from the Israeli side, the one, I don't even know if I want to call it a silver lining, but the one way of looking at it that might have a larger impact is that it's not just bringing the issue of Gaza to people's attention. It's bringing the entirety of the issue, right? We're talking about the idea of a Palestinian state again, a lot more, or at least the fact that Palestinians everywhere, whether they're in the West Bank, whether they're in East Jerusalem, whether they're in Gaza, this is an issue of broad liberation and continuous oppression from the state of Israel. So it's bringing that conversation center stage in terms of global politics, and it's been missing really for a very long time because people have been focused on normalizing, right? Normalization deals that are really just arms deals between Arab countries and Israel, and the issue of the Palestinian cause has been entirely ignored, and that's kind of impossible to ignore now.
Biden and Netanyahu just talked this morning, but of course Netanyahu canceled his trip to the U.S. after the U.S. didn't veto the ceasefire resolution at the Security Council a couple weeks ago now, but they talked today. And in the run-up to that, we saw all of these leaks and sources from inside the White House talking about how pissed and angry Biden was and how tensions are high in the run-up to this call. Reportedly, from the readout of this call, Biden emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation are unacceptable. He pushed for a ceasefire, temporary. I want to be clear, even though the Biden administration and U.S. media is calling what they are describing a ceasefire, it is really no different than a humanitarian pause that they were talking about 5 months ago. If it's not permanent, it's not a ceasefire. And that is being spun as Biden cracking down and being tough on Netanyahu. I'm curious, a couple things. Is this that, for one? And, you know, is there any good that comes out of it? Because assuming there's just, you're of the mind, like me, that this is, you know, too little, too late. It's just him trying to save face. Is there any silver lining to this meeting and the outcome?
Well, there's a couple of things you can say that are positive. Number one, anything that gets aid to people on the ground is important, right? If it's one more truck than they were going to get, that's still better than having not gotten it, right? So that's a positive development. The fact that there's certain levers of pressure, I think, that are actually working on the Biden administration to try and even if it is genuinely for PR, but if it's pushing to get more aid in, yes, that's positive. And I don't want to undermine or diminish that. But what you'll probably see from Palestinians on the ground is this is not even close to what we need. This is nowhere close to what we need. In fact, what they are saying is the issue is aid, of course, but the larger issue is a ceasefire. As long as these conditions exist, right? As long as they're living in tents, as long as 85% of the population is homeless and displaced from their homes, you have no working healthcare system. You have no access to food or food security. As long as those conditions persist, you know, getting more trust in is just not going to be enough to answer the call. What it does, though, for the U.S., what it does for other Western states, and what it especially does for someone like Joe Biden in an election year, is it creates headlines that say things like, you know, angry Joe Biden stands up to Netanyahu. Is that the reality? No. No, it's not even close to it. First of all, let's think about the fact that, so if Biden could have done this because 7 aid workers were killed, what about 33,000 Palestinians? You needed 7 aid workers to be killed before you decided to pick up a phone and put a little bit more pressure? So there's that. That's one problem.
And it's also that the Chef Jose Andres is like, he's almost like a DC celebrity, right? He's got these kind of friends in high places as well. And
that's
it seems
exactly
like
what I wanted to say.
It's like a bridge too far, essentially, that they finally pushed past this red line that the Biden administration can't just ignore or pretend that it didn't happen.
Because it's a bad look. That's what it is, yeah. Right? And because even the argument that it's aid workers, more than 200 aid workers have been killed. I think it was back in, it may have been as early as November, but probably around December, that the UN came out and said, they have in no conflict have more UN aid workers been killed. This is months ago. So what happened? Why suddenly these 7 aid workers? I'm not diminishing in any way how horrifying what happened was, but it's the fact exactly what Rob said. It's because you basically have a celebrity kind of presence. And when he's going out there and saying that their trucks were deliberately targeted by Israel, that is really, really bad PR for Israel and for the Biden administration that's been supporting it. So yeah, I mean, we have to be honest. Why this sudden shift? Because you're getting a lot of bad PR.
Well, and the incredible thing about the last 6 months as well has been all this messaging from the White House and like Democratic Party partisans and supporters insisting for the last 6 months, oh, there's nothing really, what can we do? You know, we don't control other countries. We can't control Israel or tell them what to do. And people have just been insisting over and over, yeah, of course, there's lots of things you can do. You're the ones sending them billions of dollars every year. You're the ones sending them the bombs and weapons and missiles and planes and the means to which they've been carrying out this genocide. In fact, they just made another deal just on the exact same day as this strike on these aid workers to send more planes. And they've just been repeating over and over and over again, oh, there's just nothing we can do. Like, what do you, you know, we've been having these tough conversations. We've been giving advice. And he said, we can't, you know, that's really the extent of our power and our ability to limit their actions. And then as soon as this line gets crossed, where enough well-connected people in DC are upset, and, you know, you can look at these 7 aid workers rather than the 30,000 Palestinians higher than that have been murdered over the last 6 months. And then magically, oh, now we're actually having this tough conversation. You have all these State Department ghouls out there saying like, oh, we might have to start changing our strategy now. And then lo and behold, this deal gets struck to allow more aid into Gaza, which just exposes the fact that they've been completely lying through their teeth for the last 6 months, that there's nothing they can do to stop the violence. And it's really pretty amazing to me that just like on a dime, this shift can happen. And all the very people that have been out there defending the Biden administration and insisting that there's nothing they can do, immediately it's, oh yeah, now look at the tough tone that they're taking. It's really amazing.
Yeah, that's been the line from, you say State Department ghouls, because I've had the misfortune of been watching their briefings for months. So I hear everything that they're saying, and these like one-liners, you just get used to it when you keep watching it over and over again. We've had these tough conversations. We're having these frank conversations. But the one that really blew me away is Matthew Miller, the State Department spokesperson, has now repeatedly said, well, Israel is a sovereign country. You know, we can't we can't tell them what to do. We cannot dictate to a sovereign country what to do. And he goes on to say, because we can't dictate to any sovereign country what to do.
Of course,
there's the US a list would never. Of sovereign countries that would be surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
It's just remarkable when you hear about these readouts from these meetings too. Ron Dermer, basically like a U.S. Republican who's now in Netanyahu's cabinet, or he's an advisor to Netanyahu. I don't know if he's officially in the cabinet, but he's a pretty high up Israeli official, was like yelling on a call recently. And it's just like, the way they're pushing the U.S. around, the Biden administration around, it's just, and then you bring up that comment from Matthew Miller, it's just, who's the superpower here? Who really needs who in this situation? It's just baffling that they are almost entirely reliant on the U.S. to get their back through all of this. And despite that imbalance, despite that leverage, the U.S. still kind of operates, and the Biden administration still kind of operates out of fear and deference. It's just really bizarre. Why do you think that is?
I wonder if it's fear and deference, right? I mean, I think there's definitely the fact that we have the way that politics in this country work, right? The fact that you can have powerful lobbies, and this isn't just foreign policy. This is within every policy position that doesn't tend to match what people actually want is because you have powerful lobbies behind them. And so you can talk about sort of the political corruption within our own system. How do we get here? But I also think that Joe Biden has sort of a uniquely ideological outlook when it comes to this particular issue, right? I mean, he's very proudly talks about the fact that he's a Zionist. Zionism is an ideology, right? So when he says, I'm a Zionist, he is attributing his policy to a very specific ideological point of view. And in a way, I think it's driven by him individually, right? And it's because he is the president. I mean, he sets the tone. He's the one who sets the policies. It's not the State Department that sets the policies without his approval. It's the other way around. So I think there's a strong ideological component because there's a sort of extremism that we never talk about when we're talking about the U.S., when we're talking about the West, right? Extremism is just isolated to our adversaries. It's just Muslims that are extreme, right? Jews and Christians can never be extreme, except that's not the reality. I mean, you have Israel claiming that it's representative of the entire Jewish world. Of course, there are Jewish people who do not agree with the sentiment, but there is that kind of fanaticism, I think, in the way that people think about it. And it's just become so it's become so mainstream to believe this. I don't know why it's so challenging to say, you know, Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, you would never think that that would be the person who would stand up to Israel. And now in the year 2023 and 2024, a Democratic president wouldn't be able to do that. And yet that's the reality. That's the case. So you have a history of Republican presidents who have stood more resolutely against something Israel was doing, not because they stood against Israel, but a policy or something that was happening because they knew that it was detrimental to U.S. interests as well as to Israeli interests, right? And it's somehow on this administration, even that is lost. Like, this is not, how is this helpful? How does this actually help Israelis be secure? How does this help Israeli security? It doesn't. That's why there are people within Israel who are objecting to this particular government, the Netanyahu government, as well as the actions that they're taking in Gaza. So, and I'm not saying that. I know that a lot of Israeli society is very much for what's happening, but the point that I'm making is I think there's a gap in understanding from Washington what our actual national interests, what security interests are, and what is sort of this zealous point of view that says we're going to support this no matter what. And it almost feels like they've dug in. There's nothing they can do now, because if they were to actually relent, they would have to admit what we've all been saying for months. They would have to admit that they were wrong.
Yeah. And I mean, on that subject about how, you know, this has made Israel significantly less safe currently and in the future, it's another talking point that's been used by people in the Israeli government and people in the Biden administration saying, like, well, we just have to ensure that Hamas is defeated and that no, there will never be a repeat of October 7th, that an attack like that will never happen again. And it just seems to me that all they've accomplished over the last 6 months is ensuring that not only, even if Hamas goes away tomorrow, there will be other resistance groups that are going to engage in armed struggle against Israel. And there will be other attacks like October 7th. Like, it's impossible to imagine people that have lived through the last 6 months and the horror and the depravity of it that wouldn't want to devote their lives to engaging in that. You know, this whole thing has been approached through this entirely false premise that if we just kill enough people, that then surely that will secure our security permanently. We'll defeat all our enemies and we'll prevent these attacks from happening again. And all it's done is just disrupted this entire normalization process that was ongoing. It's radicalized an entire generation of people, not only in Palestine, but around the world. It seems to me that everything that they've done over the last 6 months has made the entire existence of Israel and the sort of Zionist project less secure and less stable than it was previously.
Yeah, and when you say it's, you know, the way that the whole thing has been framed, it's been framed through the lens of Israel. It's the Israeli narrative that we're hearing constantly. It's just that the U.S. officials just keep repeating the Israeli narrative, and it's not even, you know, the Israeli narrative is a monolith. It is the most right-wing, ultra-nationalist Israeli narrative lens that we are seeing it through. So from that point of view, yes, maybe this makes sense. But that's also the point of view that's making genocidal statements. So they also seem to think that genocide makes sense. Let's flatten Gaza. Let's burn it to the ground. You know, using biblical references, and this is from the prime minister to the defense minister, from, you know, the cabinet, the Knesset, is personnel, like social media figures within Israel, military personnel. So you have a way of looking at it that can rationalize anything, including at least plausibly committing genocide, right? So that's how far this narrative has gone, that they can somehow justify in their minds. I mean, if you look at the numbers that you hear from Israeli officials, right, they'll say things like 13,000 Hamas members have been killed. But if you look at the actual numbers, that would mean that every single man, every single male killed, and some women and children would have to be counted as Hamas members for those numbers to work out. So this is the narrative. The narrative is basically all of these people are collectively responsible for what happened on October 7th, and therefore collective punishment is justified. And you see the US repeat those points, right? Even when they abstain from a ceasefire resolution, and then they call it non-binding, they'll say, well, only a ceasefire, only if the hostages are released. Meaning if the hostages are not released, Israel is allowed to continue to collectively punish everyone in Gaza, which is a war crime. But these are the talking points that
including their own hostages.
They've killed more hostages than they've saved.
Yeah.
I mean, besides the actual release of hostages when there was a negotiated ceasefire and deal, besides that, Israel has killed more of its hostages than it saved. That doesn't point to, you know, caring about the hostages very much.
No.
They also need to eat as well.
I want to bring up a report from 972 magazine that looked into the use of AI systems to guide the IDF on some of these operations. And what 972 found was that in addition to another AI system called Gospel, they rely heavily on a system called Lavender, which basically generates AI, like an artificial intelligence generates targets for assassination. It basically assembles a kill list for them, tracks them, maps out Gaza. And what's really alarming is how they almost completely, according to this report, relied on it for targets. They just deferred to this system and its outputs to guide them on where they would strike next. Beyond that, what was really troubling and led to a very quickly and rapidly increasing death toll, especially in the first couple months of the war, was that they had standards for their targets. And the investigation found that The IDF decided in the early weeks of the war that for every junior Hamas operative that Lavender marked, it was permissible to kill up to 50 or 20 civilians. And then for every senior Hamas official that were targeted, the army authorized the killing of more than 100 civilians. So when you think about some of these strikes, Jabalia, the refugee camp, that was just devastating. What was the language used by Israeli spokespeople, right? Oh, there were senior Hamas officials there. We knew they were underground. That was how we got to them. So in their minds, they were just following these guidelines. Oh, there's senior Hamas officials there. We can kill hundreds of people, and we're still by the books. And that then created that scenario where they were just bombing houses and wiping out entire families, entire bloodlines in one fell swoop. And to them, it's, all right, we got our target. And it was all guided by AI, which is just so disgusting.
It's dystopian, right? It's terrifying. The idea that this is sort of the next phase of where warfare is going to go. But it's also quite revealing, because one of the questions that has been repeatedly raised in these press briefings with Biden officials is, well, if you keep telling them you have to do something to minimize civilian deaths, and you say that they have not violated international law in any way, and they are trying their best to minimize civilian deaths, then why have so many civilians died, right? I mean, Israel is literally setting records. We have the most aid workers, UN aid workers that have been killed in a conflict, the most journalists that have been killed in a conflict, the fastest acceleration of hunger and famine that has ever been seen, the largest cohort of pediatric amputees, a historic pace of civilian death. I mean, it's mind-blowing when you look at how much death and destruction has been caused in such a short period of time. And then for them to say, well, they're not really targeting civilians. But this explains, if this is the quotas that are being used, right, this helps to explain, well, this is why so many civilians have been killed.
One other thing I want to add, the reliability of this system should be mentioned. The officers, including sources for this report, said that Lavender's calculations were accurate only 90% of the time, and they knew this. So even who they were going after, there was a 10% of the time, the targets weren't affiliated with Hamas at all. Not if they were, it would justify killing an entire family or blowing up entire neighborhoods or refugee camps. It's just, they knew that beyond just how reckless of a strategy this was, they also weren't going to get their intended target 10% of the time. That's just horrifying.
There's also, you know, I think when we're talking about Gaza, and I kind of mentioned this earlier, the way that the Western narrative, which again mimics the Israeli narrative, works is to center Hamas and to center Gaza. And obviously Gaza is being centered right now because of the atrocities and the crimes against humanity that we're seeing every day. So that part of it, obviously rightly so, but the issue is not just about Gaza, right? These issues are connected. And it's intended to compartmentalize, the Western narrative intends to compartmentalize these things, because that sort of confuses the public, right? They don't realize that these are actually connected things. They just think, well, Hamas is a terrorist, Hamas is bad, Israel has to get Hamas. But few people know the history, right? Because that's why they don't want to talk about anything that happened before October 7th. They don't want to talk about the fact that the occupation predates the existence of Hamas by decades. So there's a sort of clever way of centering these issues and separating them out, when the underlying issue is the occupation. The underlying issue is the fact that you have a population of millions of people who have lived for decades without self-determination or rights, that they have been under a military occupation. And without understanding that, nothing, you know, October 7th, you're not going to understand. You're not going to understand the aftermath either. So that's one of the things I think that's really important always to bring into the conversation. Because even when you think of what you just described, how this AI is working, right? Again, it's, well, it's trying to get Hamas. And the assumption is simply that that's the problem. That's the only real problem here. If we were to eliminate Hamas, that would solve the problem. And nothing could be further from the truth, beyond what Rob said, which is, well, the tactic you use to try and eliminate Hamas as a group, maybe you get rid of the individuals, but you cannot get rid of the idea, because what you've just done is actually create, you probably radicalize even more people towards the idea of armed resistance, towards the idea of Palestinian liberation. But again, it sort of ignores the much bigger picture, which is a decades-long occupation.
Yeah, I'm always stunned by people that use this kind of argument when you talk about the differences between like the IDF and a group like Hamas. And they say, well, you know, why is any kind of like Palestinian resistance group, why is that terrorism while the IDF is a legal army? And they say, well, you know, these resistance groups, they target civilians. But when Israel kills civilians, it's by accident. So they kill civilians on purpose. And when we do it, it's totally by accident. And that's supposed to like be some valid distinction that works on people. When, as we're seeing, like, it's actually not by accident at all. When you get into this, this incredibly dystopian program, which I'm sure is going to also be eventually, after it's been tested out in Gaza, is going to be used on other battlefronts and other type situations in the future as well. And I think you bring up another point as well that I've been curious about over the last couple of months, because, you know, obviously we all want to see a ceasefire happen and we want to see an end to the violence, and you know, everyone wants that. But I can't imagine also for people in Gaza or the West Bank or anywhere, I don't know that there's going to be an appetite to just go back to the regular everyday violence of the occupation and the status quo that existed before. That, I think, is one thing that we've kind of passed this point of no return, where I don't think it's really possible to go back to that. I don't think there's any appetite for that. So I think that's the kind of interesting thing about this moment, is you got to wonder where that's going to take us, where that's going to take the situation. Because again, we got a whole generation of people that aren't going to forget what has happened over the last 6 months. And this idea that it's going to be sold as some kind of victory to just go, okay, well, let's go back to the status quo, how it was before on October 6th. I think for a lot of people, that's not going to be acceptable. And like you pointed out, it's the reality of the occupation and the violence inherent in that led to the October 7th attacks in the first place.
And when you say that, some people will get angry because they'll be like, oh, you're justifying it. I'm like, that's not explaining why something happens is not the same thing. But if you don't even attempt to understand it, then we're just going to be stuck in this cycle forever.
I'm sorry. I know it's upsetting to people, but just this idea that history started on October 7th, it's just childish. It's just a childish way of looking at things and pretending that there's not decades of context prior to that led up to that moment is just like not an actual analysis of what's going on. You're not a serious person if you're not taking any of that into account. And it's the same people who will say that the October 7th attacks weren't justified will say that all the violence of the last 6 months was justified because of October 7th. It's this double speak, double think way of just completely dismissing this whole notion that you should provide kind of context or understanding of the history of what's been going on over the last couple of decades. But I guess that's just my point, though, is that I don't know what your thoughts are about this, but I just feel like for many people, the idea of going back to that status quo is not going to really be that attractive of an offer.
Well, you know, Matthew Miller said exactly that. The idea that, I think there was one of these press briefings where one of the journalists was trying to sort of, you know, contextualize and have this conversation, say, well, you know, but what about things that were happening before? And he just immediately stopped him and said, nothing that happened before October 7th justifies what happened on October 7th. And essentially he said, I'm paraphrasing, but everything that's happened thereafter is the fault of Hamas, right? So it's this very weird situation where it becomes logically and physically impossible to place any responsibility on Israel for anything, right? That's the cleanest way you can get away with saying, well, it's not even possible for Israel to be responsible for something. But the justification is so weird because Palestinians are not justified in using violence as a means of resistance despite decades of oppression, but Israelis are justified in carrying out the worst atrocities we've seen this century because of October 7th. So it's a backwards logic that makes just no sense. If you really
Palestinians are also not justified in using nonviolence either, whether it's BDS or the Great March of Return or anything.
The Palestinians are just not justified.
There's really no form of resistance that's available to them.
Absolutely. And that's so important to bring up, because that's the other part of the story that's always left out. As if I've heard this, people will say things like, you know, why do they have to be violent? I'm like, well, you know, that's a huge misrepresentation of what this cause has been for decades. Palestinians have tried many nonviolent means of getting world and global attention. The fact that BDS, I think, is one of the best examples. BDS is nonviolent. I mean, you cannot describe it as violent. This is the use of your own. Even you as an individual are not allowed to say, I don't want to purchase this brand because, you know, they have factories in the West Bank and they're illegal factories because they're taking up land that doesn't belong to them. If you say that, that is somehow not allowed. Protests in Palestinian territories are not allowed. People are, the Great March, how many people were killed, right? They were using live ammunition on protesters that were not using violence. So there's no means to which, and so what's the conclusion that we can draw? It's because Palestinians are not allowed to exist. And this is the part that people don't want to admit. What all of this means is the reason why it's okay for Israel to kill Palestinians is because Palestinian lives don't matter. And the reason why it's not okay to kill Israelis is because those lives do. And that's what it becomes, period. The reality of it is all of them should matter, right? Like, it's not about picking a side, but the issue is an asymmetric power dynamic. We're pretending like these are two sides with equal amounts of power, with militaries that are fighting out some kind of conflict. That's not what's happening. You have one side that is the only nuclear-powered country in the Middle East. You have a nuclear-powered advanced military supported by the most advanced military, the most powerful country in the world, occupying and oppressing another group of people. One is the occupier and the other is occupied. There is no way of getting away from that asymmetric dynamic. And that's what's always missing from the narrative.
There's one thing I want to go back to, Rob, about people being like shown that they're right. We're seeing this especially now this week after the World Central Kitchen aid workers were killed. You have moderate members of Congress. You have pretty hawkish national security officials making the rounds on, you know, CNN, MSNBC, talking about how we need to start conditioning aid, or talking about how there needs to be a ceasefire. And people are lifting them up and saying, like, look, even so-and-so is saying it now. And it's like, yeah, well, there are people who from week one, we're saying this, but those are dismissed as like fringe radical lefties. And it's like,
yeah,
those fringe radical lefties seem to have been 6 months ahead of the game on this exact talking point. And it just, it is kind of interesting to see who gets lifted up in this conversation. It's like Chris Coons. Well, even Chris Coons is saying it now. And it's like, I guess that shows just how bad it's gotten. But imagine if you didn't dismiss the people who were saying it week one, what it would look like right now. Who would still be alive? Those aid workers, probably a good chance they would still be alive, because that seems to be the catalyst for a lot of people. It's a group of mostly white aid workers from other countries. You didn't care when it was 30-some thousand Palestinians. Now you care. I mean, if that's what it takes so no one else dies, okay. I'm sure we'll still see suffering, but my God, this idea that because hawkish people finally can't accept it, like you said, Rob, because both of you, Jose Andres is a beloved figure. It's just, it's boggling my mind. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. But I hope, I doubt it, but I hope that in future circumstances, people who showed their understanding of just how awful Israel and the IDF can be, and is, that their cries will be listened to much earlier. But I just don't have high hopes for that.
In terms of the political discourse, I think one of the most frustrating things, and this speaks to what you were talking about, Jordan, is, you know, on, because we've seen these protest campaigns on the election trail, where with primary votes, right, you have these primary voting campaigns to vote uncommitted. Right. And the reaction, obviously, domestically in the United States, at least for a lot of people on the Democratic side, is anger towards people who are using their, you know, their rights within a democracy, which is their right to vote, the way that they see fit, which is to say, well, we don't want to support a candidate who is enabling and complicit in a plausible genocide. That seems like a pretty low bar for what you would expect. But you see this sort of discourse from the Democrats that's like, well, are you going to be those people who just vote on like a one issue voter? And it's mind blowing to me because it's like, well, if the one issue that you're talking about is the mass slaughter and starvation of children and the worst crimes against humanity being carried out with US tax, with my tax dollars, then yeah, that's going to be the one issue. I think the moral outrage should be saved for the people committing genocide, not for the people trying to stop it. So it's just a really bizarre kind of political discourse.
The framing around those vote on committed campaigns or leaving the ballot blank, especially one of the earlier vote on committed campaigns was met with, or that those campaigns were met with people like Fetterman saying, well, you're just helping Trump. I guess you just want Trump to win, something like that. And of course, any rational person can see that voting uncommitted in a primary does not give any advantage to Donald Trump, who is the Republican nominee that Biden would face in the general. If they sit out, sure, that might be a risk for Biden, but that's a problem that Biden and his team would need to worry about. And like any issue, any political issue in any election, you should figure out how to win those people over rather than just admonishing them, beating them over the head and saying you have to vote for us because the alternative is worse. At this point, I'm not quite sure what on this issue specifically, how to distinguish the two. But Fetterman also is, again, showing to be a pretty sick person with a sick team on the World Central Kitchen story, saying today, while screenshotting a clip from a story about Biden's meeting with Netanyahu and talking about how he's threatening to condition aid if Israel does not address its, in short, he didn't use these words, but I'm saying human rights issues. And Netanyahu shared that saying, in this war against Hamas, no conditions on Israel. And I guess even for some people, like we mentioned, the people like Chris Coons, they're disgusted by this. There are a lot of people, hawkish NatSec people, are disgusted by this and think it's finally crossed the line. But for Fetterman, it's just really bizarre. Nothing seems to ever cross the line for him. Nope. There is no limit for him, which is just wild.
No, I mean, it is amazing. It's like he's, this is like the thing, this is his, he's tied his entire political career to just really, really supporting genocide, supporting the mass murder of little kids. It's been such a stunning turnaround. Just, it seems like just not so long ago, we were having a laugh about the silly Fetterman clone conspiracy theories and that kind of stuff. And this is now his central political issue that I guess he's talking about, and he just keeps on going. No, there's just no crime. Like, just every day we see yet more examples of the most horrific things we can imagine. There's just the withdrawal from Shifa Hospital, which I don't think we've talked about enough. I don't think our media has talked about the horror of that enough. It got immediately removed from the headlines because of the attack on the aid workers. There is another horrifying video that's released today showing Palestinians being targeted by snipers while picking up airdropped food aid. Every single day, it's something like this that comes out. And there's literally nothing that can happen that John Fetterman will consider any kind of a red line or that there should be any kind of constraints or limits or that the United States government shouldn't be conditioning aid or really doing anything to prevent them from continuing to act in this like totally outrageous criminal way. It's truly something to behold.
And that, I mean, that's the kind of sort of ideological extremism I was referring to, right? It's like that those are the, so there's political expediency, obviously, is one reason to take certain political views. But you can see the difference with like the more shrewd politicians who are like, okay, well, this is no longer serving a political purpose for me, because it's gone too far. But for the ones who are sort of, they will hold on no matter what. I mean, that cannot be explained with politics or really any kind of like rational thinking. And I think what's hard for us to really grasp is you know, how, when you look at historical atrocities, people very often ask, like, how did that happen? How, what did people do at the time? Like, how did society allow these atrocities to take place? And yet they did. And because at the time there were people who, no matter what was happening, tried to rationalize it, tried to justify it. But the only way to justify it is if you dehumanize an entire people, right? That's how atrocities get justified. They don't get justified based on rational thinking. They get justified because you systematically take a group of people, dehumanize them in a way where they're seen now as subhuman. And so now you can justify everything under the sun, including their mass murder. This is not the first time we've seen these types of events take place, at least historically. It's just that when we find ourselves in this moment, you know, where historically people were not getting these atrocities live streamed to their devices, right? That's just not how this happens usually. So I think that's the cognitive dissonance that so many people can't wrap their minds around. It's like, but we're seeing it. So how is it not possible to stop it?
While we're talking about this kind of extremism, you know, we can talk about the extremism of Israelis or their enablers, but, and you talked about how it's only Arabs, it's only Palestinians that can never be extreme. And that's never applied to Israelis, nor is it really applied to the evangelical movement in the United States government. These people that are, their entire support for Israel, their entire support for Zionism is predicated on these deranged, like, apocalyptic end times prophecies. Like, that's extremely alarming. I saw this tweet from someone from the Daily Wire today, Cassie Akiva, showing, oh, look, red heifers in Israel, which is apparently part of this kind of, like, biblical prophecy about the apocalypse, which is, like, part of the temple that needs to be rebuilt before Christ can return and all this stuff. And meanwhile, you have Israel provoking Iran, like, assassinating their generals and officials in their embassy in Syria. And it just seems like there's this effort right now to escalate this even further, to escalate this into an even greater regional war. And you have people salivating over this because they believe it fulfills some kind of, like, religious prophecy that they have. And I think that's just really amazing to consider in that kind of context when we think about extremism and how which sides count as extremists and which don't. This is, like, a central mythology or a central ideology to a lot of very powerful people that are supporting this right now, that harbor these kinds of, like, extreme religious views about the apocalypse. You know, maybe that's something we should examine a little bit more, rather than pretending that the United States is some kind of, like, beacon of freedom that is just supporting Israel because it's the right thing to do and because all their neighbors hate them for no reason, which is obviously not true. You know, maybe this is something we should think about a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, you're describing our former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. Pompeo was asked during the Trump administration if he believed that God had sent Trump to save Israel from Iran. This is how this question was framed. And Pompeo, you know, said as a believer that that's something that he would have to, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a possibility. And this is the kind of, like, frightening concept that you would associate, like, if I described that as happening in another country, you would associate with some form of religious extremism. But this is our former Secretary of State who really dictated our foreign policy. And this is the logic that allows the US to say things under that administration, like, yeah, Israel can just annex land. It all belongs to Israel, according to the Bible. So it's frightening. I think one of the things that we don't talk about when we talk about Gaza, and I understand why, because the most important thing by far is what is happening to Palestinians, by far. But there's larger implications to what's happening in Gaza. One is on the international level, the fact that international law is just being shred. I mean, if it wasn't that great before, it doesn't exist anymore. They have destroyed, and by they I mean Israel with the help of the United States, has completely destroyed international law. But then there's domestic issues, right? The fact that why we're not more concerned about policies that are being justified using the Bible, right? Like what happened to our own societies, principles of democracy, principles of secularism? There's so many layers to what's really frightening when you look at the situation and how it's unfolded.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us, for your analysis and just your work. Where can people follow you, find more, learn more, etc.?
On X, Twitter, at ASSALRAD. So that's where my social media postings will be for anybody who would like to follow for more. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us.